About the year 600 B.C., Buddhism appeared in India. And we hear a great deal about Buddhism today. We hear a great deal about its contributions on various ethical, moral, cultural, and spiritual levels. But you do not hear very much about Buddhistic science. You do not hear very much about the patterns of basic theory which were developed in Buddhism as a rationalization. Remember, in Buddhism, you had doctors, and you had scientists, and you had biologists and chemists, just as in every other religion of the world. And Buddhism, like other faiths, had to have a certain scientific pattern by means of which natural sciences could be reasonably advanced. It was especially true in Buddhism, for this philosophy religion never attempted to restrict or limit any form of scientific discovery. The scientist could not be a heretic in Buddhism. It was assumed that he was merely exploring one mystery, and that this mystery was both scientific and religious, and that nothing that the physician could discover could be in conflict with what the mystic had perceived in his inner experience. So there was no conflict of ideas at all. In Indian Buddhism, we do not have too much further information on the atomic theory. It will be probably found in time, however, that as Buddhism was essentially reformed Hinduism, that the basic ideas that were dominant in Indian thinking did affect Buddhism, just as the basic ideas of Jewish and North African thinking did affect Christianity, so that the principles remain comparatively the same. When Northern Buddhism broke away about the beginning of the Christian era and moved north, we find immediately in the Great Vehicle, or the Pure Land sect, the coming forth of a clear statement of atomic thought. But we do not have it until that time, which would place it about the first or second century. Much of the opinion or doctrine bearing upon this subject was reserved, recorded, and taught in Tibet. And in the great monastery libraries at Lhasa and Tashi Lampu were important collections of early Buddhist works, which included contemplations upon the nature and structure of atoms. Now, this is no metaphysical hearsay. This is known to be so. This particular type of research must, of course, be made to fit into Buddhist philosophy, and here was a kind of a little rub. Because, as you remember, the Buddhists did not basically believe in the reality of matter. This kind of creates a complication. To them, the universe is a sort of area of illusion. The universe exists only because of certain psychic experiences of man. That is, the universe as far as man is concerned in it. The universe, therefore, is not eternal. Let us put it that way. In Buddhism, the universe is the child of necessity. The universe exists with all its laws because creatures exist who try to be lawless. And if man keeps the law itself falls into mystery and is never seen again. Laws are for those who break them. Worlds are for those who have not learned to live without them. That is the essential principle. Therefore, it would not be conceivable to the Buddhist that the atom could be an absolute, abstract reality. The atom, therefore, had to be some kind of a structure partaking in and of the illusion of existence. The atom, therefore, also had to be something which exists for a time and then does not exist anymore. This idea that we have of the eternity of time and space and substance, these ideas were foreign to the Buddhist thinker. Buddha never denied that man had a body, but he denies the essential reality of that body. Buddha did not say we did not have a house to live in. He did not believe in the non-reality of matter in the sense that we look at something, see in it, and it isn't there. That was not his concept at all. What he believed in was the non-essentialness of these things. They exist because man exists in a certain state. If man, for example, lived in a different dimension of consciousness, a house would be no good to him. If an individual lived on a different level of spiritual reality, his body would be no good to him. These things belong to him here and now because of what he is here and now. They have no actual infinite existence. So what are we going to do with this particular subject? How are we going to handle it? The answer to the Buddhist thinking seemed to be that your atom was the basic unit of the power of cognition. In other words, the atom is the very substance out of which thought and idea originate. Therefore, atoms are thought, idea, entities, or units. They are units upon which almost any concept can come into existence. And thinking is drawing together mental atoms. Nirvana, or the ceasing of personal existence, is the scattering of these mental atoms back again into their cause. Here we have a new dimension, a world in which space becomes thought. And in this same universe, what we call motion becomes will. Therefore, the universe exists only of will and the object of will. And the object of will is a conjured up mental image of the thing willed. To Buddhism, the will is not the separate power in man by means of which he determines to bowl over a rock down the street. To Buddhism, will is the power in man which causes him to think about a rock and to create a series of circumstances by the operation of his own will thought factor. As Nietzsche points out, and also Schopenhauer, the universe of Buddhism consists of will and obstruction, will and obstacle. So what we have now is will in the form of an energy, a consciousness, obstruction being the Buddhist equivalent of matter. We have obstruction to will. We have resistance, energy resistance, constantly operating against each other. Energy is made up of one kind of atoms. Resistance is made up of the other kind of atoms. So you have your will atom and your resistance atom. Now, what is essentially the difference between will and resistance? Essentially, the difference between will and thought. Because thought always is resistance. A new idea is resisted to the bitter end. Invited to outgrow a fault. We resist it to the bitter end. I don't mean the fault. I mean the invitation to overcome it. So in Buddhism, you have will as a motion. But this is a motion moving something that has an existence. It is moving against something else. And it is moving, therefore, against the opposite of itself. Now, this brings another interesting phase of Buddhist atomism, as actually taught in Tibet. Namely, that there are, therefore, psychic mental atoms. These psychic mental atoms we call selves. And every self is a psychic mental atom. The self, by means of its various processes, builds up. The union of the atoms which have the self principle in them results in the gradual building up of a body which has a self in it. The compound body being always equaled by the internal compound of the self element. So form and self build up together. And the more the pattern of the body looks like a human being, the more the self in that body acts like a human being. Until we finally get the human aggregate. And it is then motivated by the human self energy. Now, the self is composed of atoms, of which the greatest of them are the five groups of the skandhas. The skandhas simply being the faculties, or attributes by means of which we function in various sensory levels of awareness. We are aware because the atom of awareness in us is aware of the atomic structure of other things. It's all a struggle in the level of atoms. Now, both the Hindus and later, particularly the Buddhists, worked in a nice moral principle into this thing, which I think is rather quaint and unique. Atoms now not only have color, taste, shape, but atoms now have the potentials of good and evil. In Buddhism, atoms are moral entities. The fact that we cannot conceive them as moral, the fact that their lives are so minute that we would hardly like to assume that they have mentality or anything of that nature, Buddhism tosses this aside with a gesture on the simple grounds that our natural tendency to think that nothing is intelligent but ourselves is a pure case of egotism. Actually, the atom has intelligence. If it did not, then no aggregate of atoms could be intelligent. The only way you can escape this is to assume an intelligence apart from the atom. The moment you do this, you're back in deism again, which your scientist doesn't like very well either. Either the atom has a soul, or the atom is an soul. And Buddhism prefers the fact that that the atom is a creature with a psychic life, just as the Jains assumed that it was a creature with color and number and form and taste and flavor and these things. So now we have atoms that contain within themselves the potentials of good and evil. So that in all creatures that are composed out of atoms, there is conflict. The conflict being the psychic conflict in the atoms themselves. And the reason why conflict is so difficult to overcome is because it is in itself inherent in the very structure of things. As a result, however, of the fact that atoms have this quality, they also have the power of attracting and repulsing other atoms with the same or opposing qualities. Now, according to Buddhism, all action, all conduct, all thought, and all emotion exercises a magnetic force. And everything that we think, everything that we do, every plot, scheme, and strategy that moves through us, every condition of consciousness draws atoms, draws them from space around us. And out of these atoms is created a vehicle which is called the karma body. Now, this is a phase of the subject which probably hasn't been tossed around much lately in the West. But karma is also an atomic structure. These karmic atoms drawn into the complex of the human life therefore represent all types of condition drawn by attitude. An individual, for example, is by nature stubborn. By career, he improves it. And by the time he is 60 or 65 years old, he is a monument to stubbornness. Now, the fact that stubbornness has grown in him simply means that its atomic structure has built up. And while we do not think of stubbornness as a being, Buddhism thinks of it as a condition or a state. And Buddhism says, actually, no condition can be a non-existing thing. A thing either exists or it doesn't. If a condition exists, if an attitude exists, if an impulse exists, then it must be composed of material by which existence is possible. If your thought does not have some kind of an existence, it is not a thought. Perhaps we could explain some of these matters by our concept of vibration. But to these other people, vibration would be simply another term for atomic arrangement or the vitalizing and activating of atomic structures. So hate is a mass of hate atoms. If you draw more of them, the hate structure grows by increased vitality. Love is a group of atoms. Now, this solves something we've all been worrying about for a long, long time. Everyone has tried to find a good definition of love. It is an atomic structure. Now, that solves everything. But actually, love either is or isn't. The mere fact we cannot see it has nothing to do with its existence. If it exists, it is something. If it is something, it is atoms. That is your Buddhist statement strong. Because it must be something or nothing. It cannot be nothing because it exists. Therefore, it must be atoms. All these different abstractions are atoms. Now, we are fully aware that to a measure, we can demonstrate part of this to be true even now. We know, for example, that when we place a little sack of lavender in a drawer and it scents the contents of the drawer, that this odor is an emanation. That this odor is not simply nothing because it is not physically attached to the little sachet bag from which it emanates. We know also that the motion picture, that the television is not nothing because there is no direct line between it and the studio. In other words, things can have an invisible existence as sound. This sound is an invisible existence, it is true, but according to the Northern Buddhists, it is also an atomic structure. because it can be conveyed from one person to another. It can go over mountains and valleys and be heard. Therefore, it has to exist. And everything that has this kind of existence has to have an atomic structure. The next point that they make is that little moral point I was telling you about, namely, that according to Buddhism, the building up of the karma body by the attracting of atoms results in the gradual integration of what almost might be termed a not-self, a negative polarization. A negative polarization that becomes a kind of asura or demon, a principle of darkness, the same elementaries described by Paracelsus von Hohenheim. That this sin body, so to say, this body of error, remains with the individual until the exhaustion of karma. And the exhaustion of karma is, of course, the gradual reduction of the magnetic attraction which draws the karmic atom, until finally the individual, by no longer drawing ill to himself as the result of his own magnetic processes, as soon as this begins to slow down, the atoms are less rapid in being drawn into this complex. If man ceases hating, the hate structure is no longer vitalized. Little by little, it is devitalized, until finally it disintegrates for lack of energy. For actually, these atoms are drawn and release certain energy. And until the power that draws them ceases, the energy available in them is released for the perpetuation of the negative characteristics. Now, Buddhism, also working on this principle, comes along with another very interesting angle. And that is that beyond man, there is a series of states. There is the state of the arhat, the individual who has entered upon the path of renunciation. There is the state of the bodhisattva in the northern school, the being that stands practically upon the brink of eternal realization. There is the Buddha who has attained, not as a single person, but as an order of life. For the ancient Buddhists recognized the existence of many Buddhas. But these all consist of orders of the degrees of emancipation. Now, in the process of slowly breaking down illusion in this sense being false confidence in that which cannot endure, it is the fact that the ends we seek cannot be found in the material world that constitutes the true Buddhist concept of illusion. According to their doctrine, there is slowly built up or brought into manifestation something else, and that is that there exists another kind of atom. This other kind of atom, which is apart from the four, however, does not have an eternal existence in space. It is actually an atom that is built in the fifth element field, akasha, or the soul. And the fifth element is the thing that has a beginning but no end. And this kind of atom, to which Buddhism refers, is actually the Buddha atom. This gradually develops or manifests, and according to Buddhism, this becomes the secret of how atoms begin. namely that atoms all have their beginning in an infinite concatenation of time through infinite time and space, that all atoms begin by this process of the creating of the Buddha atom, by which, to make it as simple as we can, a new unit of cosmic energy is gradually created by the disciplines of self-direction. And as the time goes on, the impermanent or karma body composed of atoms slowly disintegrates. And at the final edge of nirvana, at the very end of things, a different kind of atom comes into existence, and this atom takes over. This atom is infinite life. This atom is something we cannot conceive of at the present time, but it is the one real type of atom that does exist, and it is not involved in creation at all. But it is the reason why everything lives. It's the reason why space and the atom can exist. And the attainment of the nirvana, as described in Buddhism, or the illumination of Buddha, is to a measure a representation of this. For it is the bursting of this great sun of light. It is the achievement of the mysterious eternal unit that constitutes the Buddha atom. Once this atom is created, as Gautama points out in a number of his dialogues, this atom comes into existence on that occasion when, with fullness of contrition of spirit and of mind, a being, no matter how humble, how uneducated, how uninformed, or what land he may live in, no matter what part of the earth or race that he may come from, whenever that human being inwardly resolves that his life shall be useful to another, in that moment the Buddha atom is born. In that moment, the service of good takes over upon the personal selfishness of life. Therefore, in the Jataka tales, where these stories are unfolded, always the beginning, 10 kalpas ago, 20 kalpas ago, innumerable ages and eras of time, all of this, the beginning is that the humble man, whether he be prince or pauper, whatever be his state, when he comes to his knees and he humbly says within himself, I desire the good of all more than I desire the good of myself. In that moment, the Buddha atom is born. It is at that moment also, according to the Buddhist, that a seed drops from the lotus throne pond at the foot of the throne of Amitabha into the pool of life. At that moment, the Buddha seed is sown in the paradise of Amitabha. Now, it may take millions of years, hundreds of ages and generations, before this little dedication, gradually flowering, gradually unfolding and expanding, comes finally to the fulfillment of its destiny. But this is the planting of the Buddha atom, the atom which will ultimately end in the magnificent burst of cosmic light in which the personal vanishes forever in the universal. This is the seed of salvation that is referred to in several of the ancient scriptural writings. Thus, there is an atom a kind of psychic atom that is created by the discipline of evolution, the discipline of growth. And it is made possible because of the akasha, or fifth element, which is locked within the other four elements, the atoms of which constitute the body and its indwelling personality apart from its sleeping consciousness. So this moves along until finally we have the emergence of this great mystery, the mystery of the complete consciousness atom. The motion of Buddhism was, of course, carried not only into Tibet, but moved relentlessly on into China. In China, we know that at a comparatively early date, not later than the 4th or 5th century, the Buddhistic schools had taken so firm a hold in Chinese consciousness that already their instruction largely completed the older patterns set forth by Confucius and Lao Tzu. Thus, Buddhism, the northern school of Buddhism, having established itself firmly in China, and having spread throughout China and Korea, and later traveling into the island kingdom of Japan. In this pattern, atomism moved into China. What do we know of atomism prior to Buddhism in China? What we have said about India will very largely cover this point. If Indian language is difficult to translate, Chinese is worse. And even the best Chinese scholars today are unable to be certain of the translation of many classical works. There is nothing more difficult in the world than to translate a highly technical Chinese document. Even the Chinese cannot always do it, and even their best scholars cannot always do it. Therefore, we have only a certain popular margin with which to work at the present time in estimating the Chinese view on this. They followed the Buddhism principle with certain distinct Chinese innovations in the atomic theory. They divided the atoms, again, into four elements, but they had a rather funny way of doing it. For instead of dividing them as we do, they divided these elements into conditions of quality of character. Thus, for example, a human being was composed of a certain number of atoms of salvation, a certain number of atoms of perversion, a certain number of atoms of contention, and usually somewhere concealed within it one beautiful, radiant little Buddha atom. And they made little pictures out of these. They were very delightful. It looked like a little package of your favorite flower seeds from a local store. They were all different colors. But these atoms represented no longer just physical atoms, but quality atoms. They were the compound which make up the life and the heart and the works of men. In medicine, however, the Chinese were also aware of a certain amount of atomic fact. And, of course, I suspect that we will not get much further with this than to the study of the I Ching, or the Classic of Changes. This mysterious book, which is said to me the most wonderful book in all the world, makes, of course, a series of diagrams called essentially trigrams. These trigrams, incidentally, are each ultimately composed of six individual units, apparently being partly derived from the Hindu system of atomics, where the six always constitute a unit. In the Classic of Changes, two marks stand out: the full line and the broken line. And upon this, the entire theory of Chinese ancient philosophy is built. These two lines simply represent positive negative. They represent what we might term life form, spirit matter, above below, heaven earth. They represent a vast number of opposing values and principles, and the symbolism by extension goes on to infinity. They also compose out of this situation a set of eight compound patterns, each composed of six lines. This constitutes the full structure of the basic concept. And one of the early missionaries that went to China pointed out that to the Chinese, these lines represented a patriarch, the creator of things, the matriarch, the mother of all things, and the three positive branches and the three negative branches, their sons and daughters. Also, that these eight, according to the Chinese story, were placed in a ship, and this ship floated upon the surface of the sea when the world was destroyed, and later when the dry land reappeared, this family of eight came forth and populated the earth according to the sworn testimony of Fu He, the first heavenly emperor. Now, this parallel to the story of Noah is rather too pointed to be overlooked. For here we have again Noah, his wife, the three sons, and the three daughters, who must repopulate the earth. This structure of lines, broken, and whole lines goes right back to our original concept of the nature of space. Namely, that space represents a polarized area in which energy and space itself become the positive and negative attributes. But the Chinese, bless their souls, they always did it that way, always made the negative positive and the positive negative. Therefore, to them, the empty space is positive and the principle of activity is negative. Why? Because the Chinese mind says positiveness is duration. A man is important as he gets older. If he's 100 years old, he begins to take on real significance. In China, that which endures is always most important. Motion ceases, but space does not. Motion is restricted. Space is everywhere. Obviously, space is the more important. And the mere fact that it is empty doesn't make the slightest bit of difference. Whether it is full or empty, it is a totality, and a totality eternal, inevitable, and immutable has the first distinction. Now, in China, as we say, there have been three great systems of philosophy operating. And as a result of that, we are bound to find in their various speculations a mixture of beliefs. So we have the broken and the whole line representing the receptive principle and the objective principle. And these two continually producing patterns or compounds. This, in turn, requires to the Chinese, however, the preservation of the concept of heaven. And heaven in this case was not only superiority and space, but heaven was also a spiritual factor. So in your Chinese atomism, you have motion, you have space. You have atoms, you have vacuum. You have these two balanced polarities. But in China, you have heaven ordaining all of the motions of atom in space or in vacuum. Therefore, heaven becomes more than the positive atom. Heaven becomes the lord of atoms. And China frankly acknowledges the existence of a power superior to the power of the atom. It does not, however, insist that this power is separate from the atom, but declares that the atom has two parts, its outer part corresponding to Earth, and its inner part corresponding to heaven. Therefore, the atoms can have their own heaven and earth. The atom contains both God and nature. The atom contains both motion and silence, or stillness. The atom contains both power and space. For each atom also possesses its space allotment. These atoms are, as in India and among the Buddhists, seminal, or seed-like. But from the accumulation of these atoms, all structures are formed. But the Chinese, with their natural love of everything that is artistic, have created a concept that the universe is assembled by the sheer artistry of law. That universal law produces not only the world, but produces it in infinite beauty, infinite goodness, and infinite wisdom. It is all these things because it consists of heaven moving through form. And we find the same thought very largely contained in the Tao Te Ching of Lao Tzu. It is motion moving in space, an infinite rhythm. And that which moves is only motion because it moves something. Pure motion in a vacuum could not be known. But motion causing atoms to dance can be known. Motion moving these atoms, both internally and externally, causes each atom to be suspended between heaven and space. The heaven above moves the atom. The space below contains the atom. The heaven and earth in the atom result in its equilibrium or its suspension because it contains both principles. And heaven and earth in the atom are the promise of man. For man is the unfoldment of the atom. In Chinese philosophy, all forms of nature are unfolding. And all forms of nature are unfolding their heaven quality and their earth quality. And they are binding heaven and earth together by an equilibrium. And this equilibrium is man being an embodiment of the principle of reason. And reason is a kind of spindle by means of which heaven and earth are united. For reason contains the will of heaven and the simple wisdom of the earth. So in Chinese philosophy, the Hindu and Buddhistic principles both come into play. But they also develop one unique principle of their own. And that is the recognition that not only is the atom dancing in the midst of infinity, but that infinity is also within the atom. That the atom is a kind of a door. And if you could step through that door from this world to the world within the atom, you would step out of a very little house into an inconceivable mansion. For that which is locked within the atom, because we are no longer worried with size, dimension, time, place, and these other boundaries which we have arbitrarily placed upon principles. That actually, if we could step through the atom, we would step from the darkness and insecurity and uncertainty of a very tiny world into a luminous world of energies, into an inconceivable region of powers and forces. And in this stepping through, we would therefore move into a new dimension of heaven and earth. And we would see an earth of infinite magnitude and a heaven of infinite power. And we would realize that the atom suspended between the two and more or less partaking of both is a most rudimentary compound, and that it is this compound that makes man possible. It is this compound that brings forth the birds, the bees, and the trees, and the flowers. But it also finally brings forth from its own potential its own equilibrium power. And that equilibrium power is man. For it is man who must reconcile heaven and earth. It is also man who must sometime learn to use and not abuse the deep, mysterious power that is locked within the mystery of the atom. Time's up.